pase, pierna derecha, directo al arco, golazo, golazo.
The world of football with a soccer perspective. This is Soccer Today with Dwayne Mullins and Kevin Larame, live on the Sports Podcasting Network.
Good day, good night, and welcome to Soccer Today for Tuesday, November 13th, 2018. We'll talk about the MLS Cup playoffs in the second half of the show. But to start the show today, joining us as always, Dwayne Mullins and Travis Clark of Top Drawer Soccer to talk about the College Cup. Travis, good morning.
Good morning. And just so listeners are aware, in case any noises are heard in the background, my one-year-old is sitting on the floor. He's home with a little bit of a cold. So there'll be a little bit of extra commentary coming from my end today.
Fair enough. And we'll get his picks at the end for the tournament. I don't know whether he's an East Coast guy or a West Coast guy that way, but we'll find out soon enough. Travis.
Exactly.
That in general, let's start with a general question, looking at the men's and then moving to the women's. How competitive was this season in NCAA soccer on the men's side? And is this a wide open bracket, would you say, or are we looking at some clear favorites?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I feel like the ACC, as it kind of usually has done over the past 4 to 5 years, has separated itself from the pack, and 8 of the 16 seeded teams are from the ACC. That doesn't mean it's going to be a clean sweep in the College Cup, and I do think it could be a little more wide open. I think, you know, you have to look first at Stanford. They're the 3-time defending champions. They lost basically their entire spine from the team, but there's just something that Jeremy Gunn gets these players to buy into and do, and, you know, they have enough level and kind of that grit and determination is kind of all you need in some of these games. So it'll be interesting to see how they fare. They're actually in the same bracket as Wake Forest again. Stanford has knocked out Wake Forest in the last 3 NCAA tournaments, twice in the quarterfinals and then back in 2016 in the NCAA title game. So I do think that there are good chances. You know, take an Akron who had an up and down season, maybe a little bit unfairly denied a top 16 seed in the first round bye. They have a tough road to go with a potential second round match against Syracuse looming, but they're a team that could definitely put together a run. And I think that if you're looking at it from a top to bottom, it's more wide open than maybe in the past few years when it was Stanford and a couple of other teams. So we'll see how things shake out as the tournament goes on.
You mentioned Akron, who was a dominant program not that long ago, within memory. They'd have to go through Syracuse and then assumedly Wake Forest after that. Talk a little bit about that Akron program. Why has it slipped back a little bit from its glory days?
Well, they were in the College Cup last year, and they lost, I think, 6 or 7 starters from that team. So their incoming class of recruits was something like between 15 and 20 when all was said and done. And they play a certain unique style. They try and keep the ball a little bit. And when you're playing the college game, that can either work or not work. And I think there's been some hiccups along the way. I do think they finished in a top 16 RPI position, which, you know, you can make the argument that they could have deserved a seed. But at the same time, I don't know how the committee works and how the committee thinks, so I can't really speak for the decisions that they make. But I do think Akron is a team to watch out for as things have progressed a little bit and improved. I think what they lack is they need more than one kind of go-to scorer. And a Canadian guy from Ontario, Marcel Zajac, stepped for them big time last week. He's out of Sigma FC and get 3 goals in 3 games in the MAC tournament, helped them make sure there was no issues getting into the tournament with the automatic bid. So I think that you're looking at a team that could definitely catch people by surprise, but it could do some damage for sure.
The 48-team field is made of champions from 24 conferences who qualified automatically in addition of 24 teams that were selected. Travis, is there any chance that a selected team can go far and maybe even play for the College Cup in early December?
So you mean an at-large team?
Yeah.
So that's the term that I use. So,
yeah, at-large.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, so take the ACC, for example, right? You only get one automatic bid as a conference tournament winner. They won, Louisville won on Sunday against North Carolina. And I think, I wouldn't put money on it, but there's an outside chance you could have all four College Cup teams being from the ACC. So that would have to be something like Duke, Virginia, or Notre Dame, Louisville or North Carolina, another bracket, and then Wake Forest or Syracuse. So that's kind of how the bracket plays out. So definitely you could see something like that. I think the more interesting thing is that an unseeded team. So the way the format of the tournament is, they have the 16 seeded teams get the second round bye. So you have how many teams? 32 teams playing this weekend. 32 teams playing on Thursday and then on Sunday. Would be interesting to see one of those teams go on a run. So what you're looking at, that's an Akron. They've got to start on Thursday. UCLA or Portland play each other on Thursday as well. And I feel like the winner of that one, if they catch fire and do well, could end up going on a long run throughout the season as well.
Another thing that fascinates me is the disparity in the conferences. You were talking about the ACC and how successful and how good the teams from the ACC are. You even mentioned it's possible to have a Final Four made of only ACC teams. Which other conferences would you consider the best in the country? You have ACC clearly with the best teams right now, but outside the ACC, which one will be the most dominant one, you would say?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that in some years it's been the Big East, although that isn't necessarily the case this year because the Big East regular season champions, Creighton, actually lost in the semifinals of the Big East tournament and didn't even get a spot. It's hard for me to go to the Pac-12, although they've had a decent turnout in terms of at-large bids. They have Oregon State, obviously Stanford, as I mentioned, who are the champions, and then UCLA and Washington. So what is that, four teams? I can't count this morning. So four of the six teams, if I'm not mistaken, made it. But it's hard for me to also say, well, the Pac-12 is really good because there's only six teams in it. So that kind of limits the amount of national attention that it deserves or it earns.
Travis, 15 of the women's card, the women's tournament's a little bit bigger because there's more women's teams.
Yes.
But 15 of the first round games were decided by three goals or more. Is it big enough? Is there enough parity to sustain this, or maybe would it be a better tournament, a little bit smaller?
I think it would be hard to make it smaller because you're looking at, there's 100 more teams in the NCAA field, and with it there are, I believe, 31 women's conferences. So, you're looking at SEC, which doesn't have men's programs, and it does have women's programs. So I think it would be challenging to whittle down the field, though the point you make is certainly accurate. I would argue that there's far less parity on the women's side because, for whatever reason, the schools that really get into it, that really recruit well, And I want to look at Stanford and UCLA on the women's side specifically. They are by far and away the most dominant and talented teams. I think someone from the ACC will come out, whether North Carolina or Florida State, and give those programs a challenge. But you could even throw USC into that group with the Pac-12 women's program where that's kind of where the power lies, and I don't necessarily see that changing. But to answer your question, I wouldn't whittle down the field. I think that would be too difficult to pull off because then you're cutting down the number of at-large spots, or you're just, I guess, eliminating programs, getting automatic bids altogether from specific conferences. So it would be much trickier to pull off. And as you can probably perceive and guess, the politics in the NCAA run deep here in the U.S.
Fair enough. All right. A lot of our listeners are interested in Jesse Fleming and UCLA, number two seed in this tournament, in their bracket, I should say. Just give us a little highlights of their season and how far you think that they're capable of going.
Yeah, so they've had an interesting year. I feel like they've had a quiet season, and yet they're a number two seed in heading into the tournament. Obviously, the tournament kicked off last weekend. They won 5-0. Jesse Fleming had a goal and two assists. And, following her season from afar, I noticed that she wasn't playing a lot. And I think there was an injury they were trying to maintain and, keep her fit. And obviously, she had her Canadian national team duties as well. So I'm not sure if that was just the CONCACAF Championship. I feel like there was a friendly ahead of that as well, or maybe the extended training period ahead of qualifying. So I think they have what it takes to certainly make it back to the title game. I wouldn't necessarily back them to beat Stanford, but it wouldn't shock me to see the Bruins and the Cardinal facing off at the beginning of December, when all is said and done, because the you know, the Bruins are two seeds, so they'll get to play home games, save for the quarterfinal. And, you know, they'll host a two-game, like a Friday-Sunday games this weekend, which will then likely determine whether or not, you know, they head to North Carolina or not, depending if the Tar Heels win and hold up their end of the bargain. So either way, you're looking at a big game or two standing between them and the College Cup, but I wouldn't be surprised at all to see. I picked UCLA in my bracket that I filled out and put on the internet to get made fun of. So I think we'll see a deep run from them, barring, you know, an injury or whatever, especially with a player of Fleming's quality in the midfield. You have one, you know, a dynamic forward up front in Haley Mace, who is also with the U.S. at the CONCACAF qualifying. And then, of course, another U.S. youth international, Ashley Sanchez, who seems to thrive a little bit when it's not, you know, when the pressure's not on just her.
When you look, Travis, at the next few weeks, obviously the College Cup will be early December on both sides, so the men and the women. If you had to choose one lock to at least make it to the Final Four, one team that you're guaranteeing us that have what it takes, I know, right? The big guarantees. But which one would it be the safest bet out there?
So if I can pull one school for both genders, I would go Stanford, because I feel like there's guarantee at least one of the men's or women's makes the College Cup. you know, I know I said the
that's a good way.
I'm definitely hedging my bets with that, but you know, Stanford have actually on the women's side have had an interesting season. They haven't lost a game. They lost two U.S. youth national team / U.S. One full team player, Keira Davidson, broke her ankle in a game against North Carolina, and then Sophia Smith, a up-and-coming U.S. youth forward who played with the under-20s. I think she had another serious injury, had to have surgery. But yet they still continue to roll opponents over. They have a forward named Katarina Macario that I don't know if I've mentioned on the show before, but she's a native of Brazil who moved to the U.S. when she was a young teenager, because her father was upset with the way the Brazilian FA wasn't really investing in her. So she came here, and now, you know, she'll get citizenship, I believe, in 2020, and wants to play for the U.S. Women's National. And at this point, it seems like a lock, because, you know, the U.S. called her up into an under-23 camp, even though she's not eligible at the time. And then in some ways, Smith's injury opens the door for Macario just to dominate, you know, provided that she's healthy, of course. Okay, can I also tack on the team staying healthy too as well, because if, you know, a horror injury comes up during the tournament, that can always change things.
Which brings me to the last question. Dwayne's going to move us in a little bit of a different direction. That's another thing I'm wondering. With the College Cup teams, with both the men and the women, the starting 11 and the 14 players in what I've been reading are really top class, but then the depth of teams is a bit shady sometimes. How important is the fact that a team needs to stay healthy throughout this tournament? In a close time.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question, because the thing about college soccer, as we've discussed before, with the substitution rules, you know, you get unlimited substitutions as a head coach, and players can, you know, they can re-enter three times in the second half, can't re-enter if they come off in the first half. So, you know, you get players that are fighting knocks, and I think that's one thing that a lot of players are really waking up to as well, especially on the men's side, is that as good as the NCAA is in some regards, the physical toll that it takes on players makes it pretty hard for them to really kick on and, you know, make that jump to the professional level if they've spent four seasons, you know, on the grind or what have you. And not to say that's an excuse, but so teams that are deeper at this point of the season, they have the huge advantage if they have fresher legs that can bring in, whether it's a younger player off the bench that can make an impact, or they can just shuffle up their starting lineup and then make changes as needed. So it makes it almost difficult to know, okay, who are the actual good coaches, and as weird as that is to say, in men's or women's soccer, because you can make these changes. You're not limited to three substitutions, that kind of a thing. So it's certainly going to factor into how this progresses and how the College Cup is decided, you know, whether or not teams can stay healthy at this point in the season.
And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that conversion to pros in January when we talk, Travis, in our annual
our annual trashing of the MLS draft.
Yeah, it's the super draft. It's become a tradition.
I just refuse to call it the super draft. It can just be the draft for me.
Okay, I agree.
All right, let's move right ahead for a couple questions to wrap this and let you get back to the little one there. But the U20 tournament's going on right now, and as much as Kevin and I want to block it out based on the pathetic performance of the Canadian under-20s, the U.S. men did move along, and we do have a lot of American listeners. So are you satisfied with what you've seen from that group of young players there, and do you think that it's just a sure thing that they're going to be going to Poland?
Oh, I would not call it a sure thing at all, but I'll explain my quick answer to that. I really don't know what to make of the U.S. team simply because of the level. I feel like the U.S. got an even easier group than even Mexico. And obviously, I don't want to really encroach on Canada. I didn't really watch them, but minus the goals that they conceded or what have you. But I feel like the U.S. got an even easier group because you're looking at the tournament and their most difficult, you know, team was Trinidad and Tobago. And obviously, that's shouldn't be taken for granted because of past results with the full men's national team and what have you. But I feel like there could have been a lot more put into the team's performance and simply trying to keep possession, maybe, you know, try to open up play and knock the ball around a little bit more. I saw a lot of direct play, which made you really wonder, like, what is going on behind the scenes. And now I think you want to throw a couple caveats at that, where you have the format of the tournament where you're playing games every other day, that, you know, you have a 20-player roster. Tab Ramos didn't have his full contingent of players available to him, with, you know, European teams getting to Knicks call-ups and whatnot. So regardless of that, I do think that the progression and the control of games could have been a lot better. As weird as it is to say that about a team that I think they scored 39 goals and gave up 2 the whole tournament. So I don't want to take results against Costa Rica or Honduras for granted in any means. I definitely think the U.S. should be fine and should make it. But again, this is CONCACAF, and you never know what's going to happen.
Travis, to finish the show with your segment, today we're going to transition after to the MLS Cup playoffs. And I'm just wondering, you have been watching some MLS Cup as well. Which team has impressed you the most so far in the 2018 Audi MLS Cup playoffs?
Yeah, the Red Bulls, I feel like, edged ahead of Atlanta United. I feel like whichever one emerges from the East will end up with the will end up as the favorites. Obviously, they'll get the host. If I'm not mistaken. But it's Sporting and Portland. I don't think Sporting or Portland can host the MLS Cup at this point, but I'm not looking at the points table, nope. So I can't really.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
So you throw that into the conversation, and you just think about, I think Sporting could go on the road and get a result more so than Portland, but for me, it's got to be New York or Atlanta. The Red Bulls probably edge it as the team that's impressed me. I know that people were down on them after they lost to Columbus in the first leg, but I thought they were, you know, they were beaten by a great goal and a great play, and in the end, it didn't even matter because they took care of business at home. And I think that I would expect to see them do it again with Tyler Adams really disrupting what Miguel Amarón and co. try to do in the final third.
Absolutely.
All right,
go ahead, Drake.
Sorry, Kevin. Kevin and I are having some communication issues here. I apologize for that. Travis, real quickly before we go, the Women's U17 World Cup starts today. We don't expect anyone to truly handicap a tournament that's an under-17 tournament because we simply don't know yet. But what is the role of a U17 World Cup, and how important is the scoreboard in evaluating U17 World Cups in your mind?
I don't think it's too critical, right? I think it's more about getting these players experience and hopefully targeting players that, you know, whatever country you are, whatever prominence of your national team is, it's about getting players experience and maybe earmarking a player or two who you think has the potential to make it to the next level. You know, I'm trying to figure it out, especially from a U.S. perspective, because you look at the U.S. performances of the past few youth tournaments, under 17, under 20, and they have been I don't want to say abysmal, but especially in the context of what the women's national team seems to accomplish, despite what I feel like shouldn't happen sometimes, I do think that there could be ways to look at these youth tournaments from a U.S. perspective and be like, okay, maybe let's try and play possession soccer a little bit more, and let's try and attack in a way that like kind of fits the style. I know they're trying to make, from a U.S. perspective, more about a pressing game at all levels. So I'm curious to see how that comes off at this age group, if it works. And then, there's not going to be a U17 player from this team. I know that may not be true on Canada's perspective with Jordan Huitema. Potentially, I believe she's on the under-17 roster and could very well end up making the trip to France next summer. But I don't foresee anyone's stock soaring that high from a U.S. side. So, it's an interesting one. And I'm looking at the U.S. group and I'm seeing a team that might be third favorites. You know, they're with North Korea and Germany, two pretty well-established teams. North Korea actually won the Women's World Cup in 2016 at the U17 level. So, and look, you look at an accomplishment like that, and there's not really much going on with North Korea's full women's team. So, like, something like that where it just doesn't really line up, and I think the women's game kind of highlights the, at this age group, if you're really technical, that can dominate at, under 17s, under 20s. But when the game becomes really predicated on athleticism, as it tends to be in the full team, that's where it's harder to maintain that kind of level and advantage. So, I'll be watching to see how this U.S. team does, see how Canada does, especially after their ups and downs of qualifying, where they just got it over the line. But I think that it's definitely worth keeping an eye on if you got nothing else to do during the day, the next few days.
It kicks off at noon. By the time most people listen to the show, it'll be
a glowing endorsement. I know, right?
It's okay. As you mentioned, the U.S. is in probably the group of death here. Korea is the two-time champions of this level, but it doesn't really convert much beyond that. Canada, for those that don't know, has Colombia, South Korea, and they end with Spain. So there's your groups. And as you say, something to do during the day.
I do think that Canada is more interesting in the U.S. in many regards, because you see those players move through quicker, at least on the Canadian side, and that makes them a little bit more, I don't want to say relevant, but I feel like that's the best way to describe it, right?
Yeah, because the lack of option. It's like, okay, it's like there's less, so like, okay, you all go. It's the bottleneck is a bit wider. Just put it this way.
Yeah, fair enough.
Our senior national team held on to that seeded spot for the draw that comes up a month from this past weekend. So that's coming up quick, too. At any rate, Travis, we do thank you as always. Let the listeners know how they can follow your work.
Yeah, definitely just stop by top4soccer.com. We'll have lots of college coverage of the D1 men's and women's tournament. And I'm on Twitter at Travis M. Clark, if you can put up with my ranting and ravings.
And we'll be right back after this very short break.
You are listening to Soccer Today. Follow us on Twitter at Soccer Today SPN and like our Facebook page, facebook.com/sportspodcastingnetwork. You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.
And we're back on Soccer Today. Thanks again to Travis Clark at Travis M. Clark on Twitter. MLS Cup playoffs Sunday, 3 games, and it started in the Western Conference. Dwayne, I keep telling you, don't sleep on Kansas City. I know it's been 5 years, but maybe I'm right this time around.
Maybe I'm well. I would put them as the slight favorite to go to the final for sure. We have a long break before we get to figure that out. So God knows we're going to have to a long time to evaluate this through the international break. At least they're not splitting a series in half this year. So that, I will give them credit that they moved the schedule to that point. Whereas in the past, we had to, that famous series that we love so much had a 10-day break between
pretty
games.
Much.
So
pretty much.
At any rate.
The conference finals, at least, yeah. But yeah, so RSL SKC, I think it was an entertaining game. The aggregate as well, but this one, Kansas City, it was 0-0. I was busy. I was actually working. So 0-0, I'm doing something. I'm not looking. I'm turning around. 2-0. All right. Then RSL scores. All right. Then SKC scores again. Not bad. This game was pretty entertaining.
Yeah, I was about to say it was the best game of the bunch, but of course I'm forgetting Thursday night because it almost seems separate from that. But
it's true.
in terms of the game Sunday, I thought this was the first one, and it was the best one. The other ones, you know, there was a bit of intrigue, and we'll get to them in a minute in the Columbus game, but not really. And the other one wasn't very much competitive at all, and really, and we'll talk about them a lot in a minute. But yeah, this I thought RSL deserves a lot of credit for standing out and getting, you know, making their mark in the playoffs. And this is a younger team, RSL, that I think is going to have something to say in the years ahead. They didn't quite go up as high as I thought they might. If you go back to my preseasons, I picked them as my dark horse pick. Maybe this sort of paid off in the end where they got this close, but ultimately I think class and quality won the day, and the best team won all four of these series. And that's good for, I guess, maybe the product. And
outside of Portland,
the only upset was
just seeding wise, Seattle was seeded higher than Portland, but Seattle did get some injuries. So, but outside of that one, the higher seeded team did prevail.
Yeah, no, that's what's going to go with. I mean, Seattle and Portland were maybe a wash. Seattle was the higher seed, you know, but I think the other three, this higher seed going through, were the seeds that were there for the reason, and we would have picked it heading into this round, that they would have been the teams that we would have thought got through. You know, we were all ready with our That's So Metro jokes. We were ready to go, especially as it stayed close for a while.
Yeah, well, it was 1-1 for most of the game, heading into the second half, too. An early goal by New York brought things level, a goal by Mule from New York was given to Aaron Long, Defender of the Year in 2018, but then the goal was changed. And this Columbus-New York game really went on his head a little later when Royer had a royal performance, scoring two goals in a very short time to give the Red Bulls the 3-1 lead on aggregate and not look back in this one. And yeah, I do feel that those two goals were really well built, especially the second one was about a 20 pass movement, and the entire team linked together to give him that opportunity to hit that shot about from 9 yards out. And Tyler Adams, he started that link up play in midfield and was the one giving the ball to Royer in the box. I thought this really showed how the Red Bulls play, but as well how they're dangerous. It's not one player itself. Like some people were saying during this game, well, where's BWP? You know, he's getting the ball once or twice and not having the looks we're used to it. It's not about one player. It's about the link up. It's about the I don't want to say the word tactics here, but it's about the instincts of those players to link up quickly, to move, to establish their dominance on the position of the field, and then find a way to break that down. And they did against Columbus late on.
In back-to-back seasons, we've seen the MLS total points record broken. And in both cases, the teams that broke it utilized depth as a key component of the way they did it. And that's, I think, what when we're talking about New York this year, you have to look at that first and foremost. They have their top-end talent guys in BWP. They have him there. He is a game-breaker. But when they take him out of the equation, there are other guys that can step up. And that is why I don't think this team is very Metro at all. It is why I picked this team to finally end the curse that has been against them for a while. And you're already seeing some people in New York, too, and getting that similar feeling that we had here in Toronto last year at this point, where it was like, you know what, I know we're the worst team, the, you know, terrible football club or whatever. It was a point last year was like, you know what, no, we're not anymore. And I think the Red Bulls fans are getting that way now, right now as well, that no, we are not the Metro Stars anymore. We are not going to do the same thing we did year after year. And look, Atlanta's a very good team too, and they're playing to go out on top with their, you know, as we said jokingly, but not jokingly, that this is kind of a short 2-year sprint and they're going to have to do a bit of a repurpose.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a hell of a series, and that's the one everyone's going to be watching. And obviously, SKC could come in and grind a game down and nick a 1-0 on the road. But by and large, you have to think that the favorite is going to come out of this East. And it's going to be, I think New York's going to be the favorite of those favorites. And it's simply to do a lot to do with their depth. This is, you know, I think in the total, you've got to call it the best. If they finish it with an MLS Cup, it absolutely is going to surpass TFC last year as the best season by an MLS team of all time. They had more points and they went to the semifinals of the CCL during the run. So yeah, you got to tip your hat in every way to this team.
And I purposely talked about the Red Bulls second to leave NYCFC Atlanta third because you mentioned Atlanta and how their window's closing. Well, the window at Yankee Stadium just closed last Sunday as well. David Villa will not be back with NYCFC. their best player since their inaugural season is gone. Their window is gone. And I feel this team is a bit in an impasse where the tactics surrounded by the way Vila plays will need to be adjusted. It's not that type of player. You can just choose another one in the world. Okay, he plays like Vila. We'll just put him in here and it's going to work. No. The DNA of this team was built around David Villa, and they've been so much better with him than without him. How will NYCFC fare in the next few years? You expect a big transition, a big overhaul of this club in the offseason, Dwayne.
Well, look, they have the money, and City Football Group has the connections to shuffle people into there. So this has got to be what they're doing, that they want to change their look in this. It's surprising, though, in many ways. Let me just quickly give you Villa's stats over his 4 years with NYCFC. 30 games played, 18 goals in his 2015 season. 35 games played, 23 goals in 2016. That was, of course, his MVP season. 24 goals in 33 games in 2017. And 15 goals in 26 games this year. So it's not like his production was going down. He's a 2 goals in every 3 games guy, has been his entire MLS career. So a bit surprising that they wouldn't try and keep him on for another run. But I think maybe there might be just a belief in that organization that this wasn't playing out in the end of the game, end of the year. And they slipped off in the second half of that year. And the second part of that stat I just ran might have scared them this year. Only 26 games played. That could have been what scared them away from committing long term to it. They, you know, there's reports out of Spain that Villa has offered a non-playing role with NYCFC to stay in City Football Group. Likely,
I don't think he wants to coach. Right? You know, he doesn't seem to me like the type of player who's gonna grind out the training session in the middle of the Manhattan. You know?
Yeah. So he doesn't want to retire. So I suspect that they will figure out a way there. Hell, maybe the big club might. Well, China's our success. Maybe the big club could use him as just a bonus striker. Hell, why not? More depth.
Melbourne. Yeah. Melbourne. Yeah, Melbourne's team. What is it? The city group team that plays in Australia.
Yeah. It's Melbourne City. But I believe that what's likely to happen here is that he will either go for a big money move in China or the Middle East. Or he will look to go back to a lower level in Spain, like a lower La Liga team in Spain, to end his career there. So that would be the options that I would think that David Villa would be looking at.
Real Betis, who just beat Barcelona in the weekend, will try to get Villa to make sure they can compete again. Who knows? But it is interesting to see how MLS teams now will move on from a big DP like this. It's almost an identity changing move, where the biggest star you have ever known, if you're an NYCFC fan in Major League Soccer, is packing his bags.
Look, and there's could be, with the CBA upcoming, I know it's blasphemous to talk about the CBA in MLS context because no one wants to think about it, but there's already rumblings that some of the owners are trying to move away from the third DP slot and instead put the money into more TAM. That would change how you build your rosters once again. And when you have big, big contracts, that might be a shift away from it. Now, there's a lot of thought that this is just a ploy within the CBA negotiations to get rid of that TB slot, to maybe try and push down the high-end salaries a little bit. And, you know, there's sort of small market up against big market, too, and all that sort of jazz. And this is all kinds of conversations that I suspect we'll be having on this show to the point of nauseam in about a year. So let's leave it now well enough alone there. But there could be just a thinking within NYCFC that there's a different, especially when they look across the river and they see how NYRB has been built, right? And they might say, well, we tried it this way, which is a little more MLS 2.0 than it is 3.0, although there's a mix. And say that we need to sort of emulate that a bit more, and maybe not paying one player $5 or $6 million, and instead having 3 guys at $1 million and spending some of that extra money on development around our team so that we can take advantage of the great amount of talent that's in the New York area might be the way to move forward with this. Because, you know, look, NYCFC has famously struggled in the playoffs. I think that there's a bit of bad luck involved in that. There was also a bit of naive tactics, particularly...
back in the Vieira days a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, the way that they tried to play TFC was insane in 2015, or 2016, pardon me, and they got murdered for it. So there's been a bit of that. But, I mean, also when you just look at their regular season performance, even they got good, but they never got great. they never broke through to become the truly elite team that people looked at. And I think that might be them saying that we need a rethink here, and via moving on from him might be the first step in that. The other option for Villa that did pop my mind is that there might be a club out there that is looking for a new DP. In fact, I could see him going to the West Coast and becoming the Galaxy's DP if they can get rid of one of the brothers. I don't think that the other folk is going to be coming back.
Zlatan's not coming back. Are you kidding me?
He's a TAM player too. Let's remember that. Zlatan was a TAM player. He ain't coming back as a TAM player. That's for sure.
He ain't coming back. Period. Like, he got like 3 red cards this year, even though he was named newcomer of the year in quotation mark. Still believe it should have been Rooney, because Rooney has been lights out and hasn't slapped anyone in the back of the head while playing. Yes, I remember, Zlatan, when you slapped Michael Petrasso in the back of the head in July in Montreal. Anyways.
No, precisely. It's he had his adventure in LA and now he's going to move somewhere else. In fact, Zlatan there's suggestions that he might be able to go back to Serie A. So
In La Liga too. There was some rumors earlier a few weeks ago when Madrid was in shambles that they were looking at adding the Zlatan man.
Yeah, that would be the equivalent of jingling keys in front of a crying baby, I think, in terms of Madrid right now, although they're only 5 points off the top.
Yeah, they just won 4 in a row, and Solari has been officially named the manager and not just the interim yesterday.
Yes, lots of fun stuff there we'll be talking about in the days ahead, because it's international break. Yay!
Yeah, exactly. The conference finals are November 25th. 5 p.m. you'll have Atlanta United versus the Red Bulls in Atlanta, and at 7:30 p.m. Portland versus SKC at the Portland Providence Park Stadium. And the return legs will happen 4 days later. The Red Bull will finish that series at Red Bull Arena on November 29th at 7 p.m. and SKC at home versus Portland at 9:30 p.m. Dwayne, before we wrap the show today, another big news yesterday. FC Cincinnati unveiled their new logo. And I'm going to preview as well the shows of the next coming few days. The U Sports CPL draft was held yesterday as well. We'll know the result of that later today. And there was a draw, blind draw, to see who picks first. And Calgary, Cavalry FC, has the first pick. And we'll talk about this on our next 2S to Solitude Soccer podcast, which you can subscribe for patrons only. Patreon.com/sportspodcastingnetwork. But we will talk about the CPL U Sports, but FC Cincinnati with their brand new colors, kind of, and brand new crest.
Yeah, and we'll also talk about the under-17s a little bit too, but we'll try and keep a little bit of perspective on that one. We all should when we're talking about U-17s. But in terms of Cincinnati's crest, look, first off, I'm not a fashion expert. My idea of fashion is I buy like 1970s looking stuff all the time. So I'm kind of stuck about 40 years behind here, I think. I don't know whether it's good or not, but I do know that I'm sick of infographics explaining to me what crests mean. They should be intuitive, should they not?
And well, at least it says FC Cincinnati. There's the horse or whatever it's called with the crown there. You know, there's that.
Yeah,
logo.
There was some controversy on that. I don't really want to get into it too much, but there's some people that felt that it was a religious symbol, and they were a little upset about that. They were even bringing the fleur-de-lis, people defending it by bringing the fleur-de-lis in. And I mean, people, what you want on your crest? We get a little too caught up in it. It doesn't really matter.
It's a link to Cincinnati. If you go back, the lion with the crown goes way back to the, I don't want to say just the Dayton Dutch Lion. The FC Cincinnati had the same with their crest before. I'm just happy it's not foosball. I was just happy they're not changing the actual branding to Foosball Club Cincinnati, which would have been terrible.
Yeah, maybe they got made fun of enough. Do you think if we still make fun of RSL for another 10 years, we might get rid of them?
No, we might
convince them they're not in Spain and that they didn't have the King of Spain, which doesn't even exist anymore. Anyway,
when's the last time you actually heard someone refer to RSL as Real Salt Lake? For me, it's been RSL for years. Who says Real Salt Lake anymore? Nobody. Well, it's RSL. RSL. Just call yourself RSL already.
So most people do. I certainly always call them RSL, and you'll note that I always call them SKC too, because I don't think Kansas City is in Portugal. So anyway.
Well, to be fair, there's a lot of sporting clubs outside of the one in Portugal too, in Lisbon, and there's others as well. But if they would have another sport linked to it, if you have a basketball team, fine, call yourself a sporting club, because you're an actual sporting club with different sports. Right now, you're a soccer club. But anyway.
Yeah. I'm okay with football, too, because, you know, we know what that means. But yes, anyway, enough of this silliness. No, look, Cincinnati, what will matter is how they run the team on the pitch. And there's an interesting conversation to be had about, you know, the success of Atlanta versus the struggles of Minnesota. And they both came in at the same time with the same advantages that have been given to teams in this particular expansion period. And like Minnesota, Cincinnati is coming in with a pre-existing structure. And it'll be very interesting to watch to see whether they launch closer to Minnesota or closer to Atlanta. And I think that'll be a true test on whether or not there is a disadvantage to coming in with the pre-structures now, as opposed to what it was when Montreal came in, where you looked at that and went, that's an advantage. Now with Tam in that and having a clean slate, that to me seems like you'd rather have it that way. But we're going to find out soon enough.
FC Cincinnati will have 5 players in the expansion draft that is going to be held on December 11th, 2018. So we'll know more about the composition of FC Cincinnati's roster. We already know Fernando Adi, Fatai Olaseye, and a few other players playing with FC Cincinnati will be part of next year's roster. So it'll be interesting to see which addition they do choose to make in the expansion draft, if any, or if they do the LAFC ways of getting ammunitions, getting trade baits, and then finding ways to trade with other clubs in the league to get the actual pieces they want, just like a Betashore, just like a Laurent Simard and company. So that's interesting. As always, you can follow Dwayne on social media at 24th Minute, myself at Kev Laramie. Thanks for your patronage at patreon.com/sportspodcastingnetwork. Martin Fournier from the Quebec province, my home province, has donated in the last few days, and we thank you very much, sir, and we thank you, everyone, who helps us continue to produce all the shows we do. As always, until next time, for Dwayne, I'm Kevin. Have a great soccer.
You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.